Colonel Burke, Reel 14.
Can you give me any examples of how living conditions and operational conditions were affected by winter conditions as compared with summer? In what way did particular jobs become more difficult?
Well, winter conditions are actually, you see, they were static. We did very little attacking. For instance, the last attack in 17 was finished by Passchendaele, the 30th of November 17. Mm. Well, from then on till March, when the Boche suddenly broke through, unexpectedly, it was a case of static warfare and a few fighting patrols going out, and otherwise it was peaceful compared to the summer when there was much more action.
Well, let's carry on then with the next episode in your experiences, the period between April and July 1917, when you moved to the railway wood area of the Ypres sector. You were telling me that before the Third Battle of Ypres, in which you took part, that there was a period of training involved. What was the purpose and nature of this training?
Well, right behind the lines, they had dug only about a foot deep to make it represent the trench system of our own and the whole of the German system. And each battalion of the 8th Division, we were all trained simultaneously on this course and shown exactly where machine guns were expected to be appear or where we could see them from aerial photography, where there are trench mortars, where the lines seemed to be held thicker than other places. They also told us that in front of us, before the attack, they were going to spring seven mines. The engineers had been tunneling under the German lines, and they were going to explode these bombs, and we would then go forward. This training took place for about 6 weeks, after which we made our first appearance in the line, because we were stationed at Wiltshire. And we went up through Ypres and out to the famous Menin Gate, along the Menin Road to a place called Hooge, where we entered a communication trench which was just over 2,000 yards to the front line. Now, having got up to this front line, we found our battalion sector was marked by the railway, which was an embankment on our left, and on the right by the Menin Road. So we went into the trenches with two companies up and two companies in support of the frontline companies. But we had a period in there where we got used to the lines, knew them, and
What was involved in getting used to the line, and why was it necessary?
Well, when you say getting used to the line, you knew your way up and down. You knew where battalion headquarters were. You knew where your support people were. You knew where your ammunition dumps were, and all that sort of thing. Because you didn't keep everything in the front line with you. You had your ammunition of 150 rounds per man, and a few boxes, and the same with bombs, but you didn't keep hellish store of them there because they might all be blown up. There were different places in the communications of the battalion system, especially in the long communication trench, side places where under elephant shelters these boxes of ammunition and that were kept.
What were elephant shelters?
Elephant shelters were a dome-shaped piece of iron. It might be 3 feet wide. It might be at the dome where it reached the ground, 6 feet across. And I suppose they were called elephant shelters because it was like the back of an elephant. And there, underneath those, on the side of the trench, you'd see the ammunition kept. Well, it was kept so it was a certain amount of storm damage couldn't get out to damage it.
Was that the routine way for storing
yes,
ammunition?
Yes, everywhere. Mm-hmm. Everywhere. Well, then we, having done that, we came back to our reserve places in Wiltshire, which was a hutted camp. And then we moved up finally to the line, I think about the 27th of July.
This period in the rest camp, we haven't really talked about periods out of the line. We've said a lot about in the line. What was the pattern of activities during the periods you spent out of the line? Where would you spend them? What kind of things would you do? How would life differ?
Well, in this case, we'd moved up to a new sector, and we knew we were going into battle. Therefore, we had to make sure that every man had his allotted ammunition, he had his allotted Mills bombs, that the machine gunners, Lewis gunners, had their number of trays of ammunition that they should have. All their spares were right. All the oil bottles in the bottom, which were kept in the bottom of the butt of the rifle, all were full. And make the men generally ready for battle. Mm. Well, in a place like Wiltshire, when you finished your usual work in the morning, that's drills and that sort of thing, we would get hold of soccer, play soccer, sometimes with another unit, mostly between ourselves. Sometimes if the ground was... Well, if it wasn't waterlogged, you'd have a paper chase, but that wasn't often in the winter. And when we were in Wiltshire, the men used to go into a village which is very well known by every British soldier who'd been in the Ypres sector, named Popperinge. Now there, although it was badly battered, there were still some estaminets open where the troops could get beer and they could buy a few of the little luxuries they wanted. And there was a famous club there, nicknamed Skindles, after the one somewhere on the River Thames at Maidenhead, I think it was, where one used to go in and you could get an egg omelette or something like that. And when a lot of the people, especially the troops as well, ferreted around to see if they could get bars, because you were always trying to keep yourself clean. But otherwise, there was no amenities at all. On the way up between Popperinge and the line, there were two or three, well, there were many wrecked farms, but two or three of them seemed to be in a bit better order. And you'd see an old biscuit tin, which was about 2 foot cube. And it had lots of nail holes in it, which said Salvation Army, and you went in there and they'd give you a cup of tea and a piece of writing paper and you'd write your letter home and then they'd leave it with them and they'd get it censored and that sort of thing.
Were the Salvation Army establishments pretty regular across the front?
Oh yes, and always near the line. Our own Expeditionary Force canteens, as they call them, were far back, but the Salvation Army were well up, and what they call the church units. If you could find a place where they could get it up, and then they'd scrounge wire netting from the battalions, and a piece of wood to make beds. And they'd have tea, and they'd give you tea, and there might be one day a Catholic padre on, a Roman Catholic padre. The next day there might be a Protestant, or a Jew, or a Presbyterian, but they all took it, and they were all well up close to the line. And you could always go in there, and especially coming from the front line, sometimes troops fell out, they couldn't keep up, they were more exhausted than the others. You didn't wait for them because you knew damn well they'd find their way home. But on the way there, they'd go into these places where they were given a rest and a hot cup of coffee and told exactly how much further they had to go and that sort of thing. They were marvellous, those people, especially the Salvation Army.
In addition to the Salvation Army and the Church Army units, were there any other kind of facilities provided for the troops? while they were in rest camps and out of the line for relaxation?
Well, there were these, what they call expeditionary force canteens, but they were mostly shops. They didn't do a lot of catering for the troops, although they did a bit. But I mean, there weren't anything like the canteen, the NAFI is today. The NAFI, as NAFI, was only formed after the First World War. During the war, they were known as the Expeditionary Force Canteens. And you could buy duty-free cigarettes there, and biscuits, and chocolate, and everything like that. Sometimes tea and a little sugar. But they were good places to have when you could find them.
How frequently did concert parties entertain the troops in the rest camps?
not so much as they did in the Second World War. Not so much. They were few and far between. And it was mostly done by bringing men, your own men, and getting a divisional concert party up, so it was your own troops. But that was only when you were really back in rest. I mean, you see, you had so many days in the line, so many days in the support line, and so many days in the reserve line. Well, even in the reserve line, you were in the battle zone, you see. It was only when the division was relieved by another and you went further back that you got more civilized, and you got these concert parties then. But the time you had back there was very few and far between, so you didn't often see them.
Do you remember any concert parties and the sort of show they'd provide, and who would come?
Well,
out?
It was like the old peer concerts before the war. You know, like the Pieros. They hadn't much dress, and they used to take skits off the officers and that sort of thing. It was all very well taken, and they sang all the usual songs that were going at the time. A lot of them at that time, George Robey was the great comic in my day, and a lot of them used to try and imitate him. And then you'd get a lot of.
Were the concert parties in the main a case of the army entertaining the army, or were they ever...
Mostly, yes. It was very, very futile. I can't remember even seeing Vera Lynn was the Second World War, wasn't she? I can't remember seeing anybody but our own troops.
I see. So it would be military talent.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so after the rest period, you went back to the front for the beginning of the Third Battle of Ypres. Tell me about your experiences.
Well, we got up to the line, and then the morning of the battle came. I think we went over somewhere about 4:30. But at the last moment, it was nearly put off because it started to rain. And that, of course, would have dire results on any artillery being able to move forward, especially the inconvenience which it was to the troops, how bad and how slow it was. However, they decided to take on. So the night before, we were down at battalion headquarters to have our final briefing from the commanding officer. We then synchronized our watches, and away we went.
When you actually went over the top, was there a regular drill which would take place in the trenches?
Oh, yes.
In the immediately preceding...
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Immediately the daylight came, they had their rum ration. Well, the quartermaster was always good on those occasions. It was practically a double, because he'd filched or watered or done something with it to let us have some more anyhow. And that was done, and then you gave the men your last orders. Well, they had brief sort of ladders. They were like two bits of wood nailed together with three or four cross pieces to form a ladder to help them to get out. And then 5 minutes before the actual time of going over, which was the worst for the troops, that's when their feelings might break and that sort of thing, you'd say 5 minutes to go and you'd shout it down the left and right of your sector. Then 4 minutes and 3 minutes and 2 minutes, then half a minute. And then you'd say 10 seconds, get ready, over. Well, now all the time that you were saying this, there was a most terrible noise going on from masses of artillery. We knew, we were told, and we knew it was right by the volume of fire. They were wheel to wheel, which is unprecedented. You see, there thousands of artillery there, wheel to wheel, smashing the trenches, smashing the wire, right where we went over.